Today on Wings, women inside and outside the United Nations work for both words and action on climate change, safety, and peace.
The agreement should not remain gender blind, which it was at the beginning. We have worked to make it more and more engendered.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
After 25 years of organizing together internationally, women's organizations have won some acknowledgement of their concerns in the Paris Agreement, the final document of the 2015 Climate Summit.
Climate change impacts women in multiple ways, disproportionately, differentially. And this is something that women and girls in developing countries know more than anywhere else.
Lakshmi Puri is Deputy Executive Director of UN Women, a United Nations agency created 5 years ago.
If you look at the water and sanitation issues, if you look at food security and agriculture issues, if you look at renewable energy and energy access issues, if you also are looking at the health impacts, all of these areas are directly related to how women are impacted, but also how women try to cope at high cost to themselves and their families and communities in the end. Just to give you an example, women walk millions of miles every day in sub-Saharan Africa or in my country, India, to fetch water because water tables are going lower and lower, or due to desertification, water is further and further. You have to go for water sources to get water. That has an impact on the girls' education. Girls are made to go and fetch water, so they are denied opportunities for education. Women are denied opportunities for income-generating activities. It's the same with fuel. Cooking stoves, which are emitting carbon, are also impacting their health. All of these factors which are affected by climate change then impact women, but they have to cope with it.
UN Women is here at COP21. What is UN Women's role and agenda here?
This is a continuum of the efforts UN Women has made since its creation 5 years ago to make sure that the UN processes and the agreement should not remain gender blind, which it was at the beginning, but we have worked to make it more and more engendered, which means we have had something like 50 decisions on how to make climate action more gender sensitive. And last year, we had the Lima Program of Action on gender sensitive climate action adopted. And also every COP has an agenda item now on gender-sensitive climate action.
How do women figure in the current text of the agreement?
Well, we were very distressed 2 months ago when all gender-related references that were there in the Geneva text were streamlined out. So we worked with all our champions who were member states, and our civil society and the whole gender constituency. And we have, happily, a strong gender constituency across the different regions, north, south, different continents. And we also have a very strong women's major group and gender constituency amongst civil society. So we worked with all of these champions to make sure that not only were these references brought back in, but were strengthened, and where they were not there, they were inserted. We therefore came to Paris with a text that has reference to gender equality and women's empowerment and women's leadership and role in the preamble. Then we have it in the purpose aspect. We have it in gender-responsive adaptation. We also had a reference to gender-sensitive financing and capacity building. And unfortunately, it wasn't brought back in there or in gender-sensitive technology, because if you're finding technology solutions, whether it is for mitigation or adaptation, you have to have the perspectives, the needs, and the application of those technologies from the gender perspective. How women are going to use it, what do they need it for, how are they going to apply it? And in fact, the success of technology depends on being inclusive about women's voices, their choices, and their role.
That was Lakshmi Puri, Deputy Executive Director of UN Women, interviewed by Cristina Silvero for United Nations Radio. The document that the Paris Summit unanimously approved on December 12, 2015, creates mechanisms for collecting the same standards of emissions and mitigation data from all 200 signatory countries. It promotes financing to transfer technology to developing countries and promotes adapting to climate change we cannot avoid. Given large differences of opinion, the language is very cautious. However, women's groups insisted upon keeping this paragraph, asserting that the participating countries, quote, acknowledge that adaptation action should follow a country-driven, gender-responsive, participatory, and fully transparent approach, taking into consideration vulnerable groups, communities, and ecosystems, and should be based on and guided by the best available science and, as appropriate, traditional knowledge of indigenous peoples and local knowledge systems, with a view to integrating adaptation into relevant socioeconomic and environmental policies and actions, where appropriate. Close quote. As at previous climate summits, civil society pursued both an inside and an outside strategy toward their goals. Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma had some inside access. She is head of the African Union Commission.
African women are the ones that are charged with providing water in the home if there is no running water. They are charged with providing energy in the house if there is no electricity. They are the majority who work in agriculture. So if there is no water, it's not raining or there is floods, it affects women and children much more. If there is not enough land for agriculture, it means they have to cut the trees. But if they cut the trees, they end up with climate change and droughts, and so their land is not productive. The girls can't go to school because now they have to walk longer distances to look for water and to look for firewood. So it becomes a vicious cycle for them. So indeed, climate change does affect women much more than anybody else.
Are you calling for specific measures in support of African women in climate change?
Yes, I think if we provide electricity, that would be a great contribution to freeing women's time, women's energy from looking for firewood, but also in allowing the environment to regenerate and be more green. If there is water, it means women are freer. If the land is more productive, climate smart agriculture, it means they make more from their crops. So yes, the measures that you are looking for will impact greatly on women.
Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, head of the African Union Commission, interviewed by Cristina Silvero during the designated Gender Day at the Paris Climate Summit. Meanwhile, on Gender Day, others took to the streets.
Women will not give up on the planet. This message reverberated through the UN Climate Change Conference on Tuesday, not just because it was Gender Day at COP21 with many events throughout the summit's halls, but thanks to dozens of voices coming together to sing and dance.
We're going to keep on moving forward, never turning back, never turning back.
That was Titi Akosa, a Nigerian lawyer and the executive director of the Center for 21st Century Issues. She was one of the activists who stood out of the crowd to highlight the urgency of keeping women's rights at the forefront of climate change discussions.
This morning we have been with the women ministers from all over the world to tell them that we need them to stand strong on behalf of women in the negotiations and talk to their delegations so that they will do what is just and right for women.
Also taking part in the event was Leon DeLeon, an American with ties to the Philippines, who identifies as a gender non-conforming person. Leanne is at COP21 representing the Women's Major Group, which works to promote sustainable development and gender equality.
We want to say that with the current crisis of climate, that women and the marginalized are mostly being affected. They do not have access to the table to make these decisions. And so for us, as a women's network, we want to make sure that we amplify the voices coming from the grassroots communities.
Leanne also explained that as a feminist and gender non-conforming person, COP21 has provided a space to critique the current state of affairs related not only to patriarchy, but also on some of the impacts of globalization.
With the crisis on climate, it's exacerbating the current systems of oppression that gender non-conforming and queer people and women face in the world. Because of patriarchy and because of heteronormativity, we do not have access to healthcare, we do not have access to jobs, we are discriminated on, and so with climate change, it will just exacerbate those problems.
Despite women being disproportionately impacted by climate change, the message is also that women are a significant part of the solution. Here's Osprey Oriel Lake, the co-founder and executive director of WeCan, the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network.
The women we work with around the world, the first thing they'll say to us is, you know what, we're not victims, we're the solutions. And they're really right, because 60 to 80% of all household food production in developing countries is done by women. So there's all these issues around food security and food sovereignty, it's the women. And UN studies show that if you have all these different water programs in developing countries, if you don't involve women in the decision making around it, the programs don't work because the local water knowledge is held by women.
Those fighting for gender equality have made it clear that women and other minority groups will continue to raise their voices for a seat at the decision making table.
Stephanie Kutrix of UN Radio filed that report for the program formerly known as Women, but now titled Gender Focus.
Welcome to UN Gender Focus. I'm Veronica Reeves at the United Nations in New York. In this week's program, a unique tent school opens in Lebanon for Syrian refugees, and the Arab world has elected its first female Speaker of Parliament. But first, violence against women should be recognized as a global epidemic, according to the Deputy Executive Director of UN Women, the United Nations Gender Agency. Lakshmi Puri was talking ahead of the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, marked annually on the 25th of November. The International Day kicks off a 16-day campaign that runs until Human Rights Day on the 10th of December. UN Women says violence affects at least one in three women and girls worldwide. Pooja Premchandran asked Ms. Puri how the violence could be stopped.
To understand prevention, we need to recognize what is the extent of violence against women, that it is a global epidemic, as WHO has rightly pointed out, that it manifests itself as physical violence, emotional violence, and psychological violence. And of course, the trauma and the suffering and the disempowerment. And it is the worst form of discrimination. So we need to address the root causes.
What are some of the main causes of violence against women, especially young women?
Well, the major cause is the extremely unjust belief system that men and women, boys and girls are not equal. And from that, the whole culture of discrimination develops. And violence is the worst possible symptom of that discrimination and injustice. There are people who have been interpreting it in a certain way that reinforces patriarchal constructs of what is the role, responsibility of women and girls vis-a-vis the authority of men and boys. All of that creates this sense that women and girls are somehow vulnerable, weak, they have a lower status, so they can be easily victimized. So that is what needs to be changed.
I think you said 119 countries do recognize domestic violence as a crime, right?
There has been an assessment, a global assessment, country assessment, and everywhere ending violence against women has come out as one of the universal unfinished businesses of the gender equality agenda and its implementation. So there is a recognition by every country. And we had this Global Leaders Commitment Summit on gender equality. And in that, almost every leader of the 75 heads of state and government who came for that meeting, which was historic, they highlighted violence against women as a key challenge and a key priority to address.
Syrian children learn the alphabet in English at a school in Lebanon. This is not a normal school, not a normal classroom. This lesson is being held in a tent which belongs to Syrian refugee and former teacher Fatima.
I was a teacher in Syria. We had to come here because of the bombing. I was scared for my children and even for my husband from the checkpoints and arrests. I came here with my qualification, but I couldn't get a job here.
The UN says there are 400,000 school-age Syrian refugee children in Lebanon. Only half can find a space in a classroom. Fatima decided to fill that gap and provide children with an education.
I started to think about the fate of these children. They are all going to be illiterate, from 8 to 12, 13 years old. None of them know numbers or letters. Some parents asked me to teach. They said, open a class and we will support you.
There are no books or stationery in the class, but Fatima does have a whiteboard and it seems plenty of commitment and drive.
I started two shifts. In the first month, I had 45 children. I would teach 2 hours in the morning, two in the afternoon, around 20 in each shift. I teach three subjects, Arabic, English and math.
Despite the limited resources, the children don't miss a class. Sirene is a Syrian refugee and one of the students.
We like to study and learn. We want to study so we can read when we grow up.
Syrians continue to flee the fighting in their home country. Many living in Lebanon are hoping to be resettled, perhaps in Europe or further afield. In the meantime, these children at least will carry on studying as best they can. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
The Arab world has elected its first female Speaker of Parliament. Dr. Amal Al-Kabasi has been elected as Speaker of the United Arab Emirates Parliament, making her the first ever woman Speaker of an Arab National Parliament. She has been a parliamentarian in the UAE since 2006, where she has been particularly active on youth and gender issues. I spoke with Zaina Halal from the Inter-Parliamentary Union.
Today we have 48 women speakers of parliamentary chambers, and we have around 22.5% women parliamentarians, 22.6% this month. It's pretty low, given the fact that women constitute half of the world population. In the Arab region, this proportion is lower. It is 19%. It's important in terms of women's rights to take part in the conduct of public affairs of a country. The second reason is for efficiency purposes, to oversee governmental policies, actions, plans, programs, budgets, and represent the population. So in doing all these different functions, you definitely need different perspectives, different experiences, and different talents as well. This is why it's extremely important to have both men and women in parliament.
That was released November 26, 2015. We conclude today's Wings program with coverage of the 15th anniversary of a UN Security Council resolution committing to including women in peace negotiations and peacekeeping.
Welcome to UN Gender Focus. I'm Deanne Penn. In October of 2000, the UN Security Council unanimously adopted Resolution 1325, which stresses the important role women have in conflict resolution, peace negotiations, and UN peacekeeping efforts. 1325, as it's known, reflected a change in the way the international community viewed concepts of peace and security. More than 100 countries met at the UN to take stock of progress in implementing its recommendations. Resolution 1325 has led to 5 women being appointed heads of peacekeeping operations. There is now a special representative on sexual violence in conflict. But more must be done, says UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon.
At a time when armed extremist groups place subordination of women at the top of their agenda, we must place women's leadership and protection of women's rights at the top of ours.
Mr. Ban outlined what he called an ambitious agenda for UN peacekeeping that includes deploying gender advisors to all special political missions. 15% of all peacebuilding funds will also go to projects that address gender equality and women's empowerment. Pumzili Mlambo Nguka is executive director of UN Women, the United Nations entity for gender equality and women's empowerment.
Where women are at the peace table, they are able to make compromises that allow for faster progress, but not at the expense of core aspects of long-term lasting sustainability. In Colombia, where talks are still ongoing, women have secured an agreement which states that there would be no amnesty for sexual violent crimes.
Since 1325's adoption, not only has the number of major violent conflicts increased, there's also been a rise in violent extremism and terrorism, perhaps the greatest threat to global peace and security at present, according to the Security Council. Terrorist groups such as ISIL or ISIS in the Middle East and Boko Haram in West Africa have targeted women and girls. Yana Mohammed is co-founder and president of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq.
We at the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq have documented the execution of over 150 women in one area controlled by ISIS because they refused to obey the so-called Islamic State. In the absence of government-sponsored services, local women's groups are at the forefront of providing aid and services in places unreachable by international aid organizations. Yet we remain vastly underrepresented in our efforts to prevent and address conflict and violent extremism. Our rights are not protected, let alone promoted.
All extremists from all religions tend to be very restrictive about women's rights. The problem is, of course, made worse when things become violent.
Radhika Kumaraswamy, author of a report which aims to make Resolution 1325 effective.
We have two kinds of trouble spots, the traditional wars of Africa, where you have sort of armed warlords and people gathered around. And then you have these more religious ideological wars, which are in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, those three. One has to understand in many of these areas, a lot of these things were taking place, but nobody knew about it. Everything looks much more dangerous because media is present everywhere. So we don't know how much of it is this media hype and how much of it is reality. To see women as always victims is also not true, because you have more than ever in these same areas, women going to university, women taking jobs, women want their daughters to grow up and earn. And then there's the backlash. So there's this tension between the women that are moving forward, entering globalization, and the backlash of those who are resistant to that.
Resolution
Representatives from women's groups in conflict areas have also weighed in on the impact of Resolution 1325 in their countries. As we heard earlier, Yanar Mohammed is co-founder of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, OWFI, which operates underground shelters there for female survivors of abuse. She said sexual enslavement and trafficking of women by the extremist group ISIL and what she described as failings on the part of the government in Baghdad to treat women equally mean there is no safety for women in her country. She told Matthew Wells why she had come to speak at United Nations headquarters.
The Resolution 1325 is about protection, safety, empowerment, and legislation for women's rights. And it was abiding for all countries that are under conflict. I come from Iraq. In Iraq, neither any of those provisions of the resolution was applied by the government. There is no safety for women, as all kinds of violence, social violence, are subject on her, and there is no protection for her, as when she was trafficked under ISIS and enslaved in ways that the modern history has not heard of. These are issues that we wanted to highlight here, and we did. I did it in the speech. And I also added that it's not only ISIS that is trafficking women of Iraq. There is a lot of trafficking under the government of Iraq, which not much has been done against. And the issue of legislation, I also highlighted that women are still subject to violence because the laws still do not look at her as a full citizen, and the policies are even worse than that.
I'm sure that the Iraqi government would say that they are doing what they can to protect women under the Iraqi constitution?
The Iraqi government is not doing anything to protect women of Iraq. And when others like NGOs are protecting them, they are preventing us. They are telling us that it is illegal activity. So they look at the protection of women as a criminal activity to be held accountable for. That's the reason I came here, to tell the international community that the state that you built in Iraq is imposing violence on women and also upon the organizations of women, to ask for their assistance in forcing the Iraqi government to change legislation and to allow sheltering of women, but also to allow the voices of women.
What is it that you say are the vital changes that need to happen now then in terms of policy towards women?
The issue of saving women from honor killing and from trafficking is so high in Iraq. There is such a need for it that there needs to be a new legislation that gives the legal status to the shelters of women to be run by NGOs.
You've been listening to UN Gender Focus from United Nations Radio in New York. You can follow more of our programs at radio.un.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Deanne Penn.
Wings thanks UN Radio for continuing to cover news about women in relationship to the United Nations mission. To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. Or visit our daily news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the new book, The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.